On a recent reporting trip to Afghanistan, John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker magazine got a lot more than he bargained for. While traveling with a team of U.S. contractors and Afghan police on a mission to destroy fields of opium poppies, the group came under heavy fire in an ambush believed to be the work of Taliban fighters. John Lee Anderson wrote about his experience and what he learned about the challenges facing the U.S. as it mounts a poppy eradication campaign in last week's issue of The New Yorker. And he joins us now from the studios of the BBC in Dorchester, England. And John Lee Anderson, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, you were in the Afghan province of Uruzgan in the center of the country, much of which is classified by the UN as extreme risk, hostile environment, the provincial capital named Tirinkot. And you, beginning your piece, you describe a billboard there, which an arresting image.
Yes, indeed. It shows a human skeleton being hung by, not from a normal galley's rope, but by an opium poppy. And this is part of the central government's effort to propagandize its desire to stamp out opium in the country. But within, I would say, about 200 meters from there is the governor's mansion, governor's palace. And then just below the governor's palace, there are opium poppy fields flowering, or at least there were when I was there.
And this sort of contrast... Everybody, I guess, is formally against the cultivation of poppies and, of course, the heroin which is derived from it. Nevertheless, this is Afghanistan's biggest crop.
That's right. And there haven't been alternative economic means put in place by the international community, not to mention the central government, which depends on it, to dissuade Afghanistan's predominantly very poor rural people, for the most part, farmers, to grow anything other than opium. They don't get enough from wheat, their usual crop, and from the other fruit and nuts that they grow in order to make a living. And there is clearly a booming demand for this.
If you have questions about the Afghan drug trade and its politics, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you describe the wide-open poppy fields you saw in Uruzgan province and say you can tell which ones have the most opium.
That's right. As it turns out, when they're flowering, there's a period of about 2 to 3 weeks in which they can be harvested when the opium is ripe. And I didn't know this either, but it's quite beautiful. The poppy flowers, when they're in bloom, range from white flecked with pink to actually pink. And then there were several in most patches I saw, a deep magenta, kind of vermilion color. And those were the ones with the greatest concentration of opium.
Now, the United States has been spending a lot of money on a program theoretically to begin eradicating poppies, and of course, at the same time, more and more acres of poppies are planted every year. The techniques that would be effective, you say, would be aerial spraying.
Well, these are the techniques which the U.S. In its Plan Colombia, which is now, I think, in its seventh year, uses chemical aerial spraying also through contractors, through this military security company, DynCor, to eradicate coca, which is the plant which gives us cocaine, in Colombia. They're experiencing similar difficulties. In other words, it is effective in destroying the crop. The problem is it also destroys other crops, not to mention the kind of enduring controversy and questions about health side effects and so on. They've found in Colombia, for instance, with their aerial spraying, that the traffickers, the people who pay for farmers to grow, for the most part, have been very canny about moving their crops and planting them elsewhere. The overall number of acres of coca planted in Colombia through after 7 years of multi-billion-dollar program financed by the U.S. doesn't appear to have gone down. So even if they do manage to convince the Karzai government, which doesn't seem to be likely to implement that in Afghanistan, we're probably looking at a similar situation there. It's a real catch-22.
And the one entity that did manage to control and indeed almost eradicate poppy growth in Afghanistan was, of course, the Taliban, which is now sponsoring it.
That's right. I think there's a simple logic. It behooved the Taliban to make good on their vaunted Islamist principles when they were in power. Once they had secured most of the country, by 2001, in fact, the very same year they were later overthrown by the United States troops, they managed to effectively eradicate opium in the country and indeed were applauded by the UN for doing so. But the logic of insurgency holds that you need to tap into a natural resource in order to survive. And so they have effectively abandoned those Islamist precepts in order to survive and make headway and earn money.
There's a very dramatic scene in the story that you tell. At one point, you're with some Afghan policemen and these U.S. contractors, and somebody said, you know, wait a minute, it's un-Islamic to grow poppies to these farmers. And they point out, the Quran also tells us we have to kill unbelievers.
That's right. And he said it with a glaring look at the American contractors I was standing with, and the men with him nodded their heads. It was definitely a challenging moment. And shortly afterwards, the translator of the Americans began to tell them off, saying that, you know, I'm not intimidated by what you're saying. You know, I'm not afraid of you. I'm Pashtun as well, which is their language and their ethnic group. And one of the older men in the group said to him, "You'd better be afraid soon." And indeed, the very next day, we fell into an ambush.
Mm-hmm. And this was, in a way, part of a protection racket. The Taliban gets a cut of the proceedings in order to protect the poppy fields from just these kinds of efforts.
Indeed. And following the ambush, a prisoner was taken, and according to the information he gave, after the first day of eradication, what happened was opium farmers went to the local police, who in turn brought in the local Taliban. They then came, brought in some trained fighters, distributed weapons, and they laid this ambush against the team I was with on the second day of eradication, effectively putting paid not only to that day's eradication, but to opium eradication by the U.S., by the central government in that province this year. And that's right. It behooves them. The Americans and the central government appear to be, acting against the poor farmers. The Taliban come off as the protectors, both of their livelihoods and of their way of life. And in this case, they also appear to be more powerful and politically in control, which doesn't bode well for the overall counterinsurgency effort in various parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban are gaining ascendancy, much less the opium eradication effort.
And it also leads to incredible amounts of corruption, as you point out. For example, the areas, the fields that this unit was directed to destroy belonged to one tribe, not to the prime minister's tribe.
Well, that's right. And this, again, is consistent. I also heard this from the contractors, the Dyncorp men. They had come from another province where most of the opium is grown, Helmand, which is also the hotbed of the war at the moment, and found themselves repeatedly directed to certain fields. This is after councils between their own, police captains who have to hold councils with tribal elders and local police chiefs and so on. And they would find themselves very often driven past hours, in some cases, past large fields of opium, only to go and destroy some usually poor farmers' small patch. And a similar pattern was emerging in the very brief time that they were able to eradicate Enoda's gun. I pointed this out to them. They all admitted that this was the case, that they weren't even sure if the people they were working with were not corrupt. Most believed them to be on the take. And their best argument was that with time, if we show we're serious, we'll win them over. We're just going to show them that we're not going to go away. It's a kind of a wishing, almost like a wishing scenario. Nobody in Kabul at the highest level in the American part of this effort could promise me that this was going to work, or even that they had the policy right, merely that they were trying it.
Interesting also analysis of, we'll get to callers' questions in just a minute, but analysis of Prime Minister Karzai's difficulties where his base in the northern part of the country, there are people now organizing against him.
Well, that's right. In the six-odd years now that Afghan has been post-Taliban. Karzai, of course, was selected by the international community. He's since won an election. But the people who actually fought the Taliban and seized Kabul and initially cohabited in power with Karzai haven't been effectively, for the most part, sidelined by now. They were, some of them were warlords with the former Northern Alliance and so on. Most of the key figures are now sort of marginalized. Now, they see this resurgence of the Taliban over the past 2 years, this past year in particular, as very threatening. They see Karzai as having Pashtunized the government, effectively sidelining the Uzbeks and Tajiks of the north who fought the Taliban. They see his efforts to negotiate and to open up dialogue with the Taliban as a kind of appeasement. And they're beginning to form a bloc which hopes to unseat him in elections and to change the parliamentary system. But there are also people in the north. The nephew of the late legendary Mujahideen commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, for instance, is actually forming an armed group. I met with him on my last day in the country. He's been very cautious about meeting with the press. In fact, he's never met with a journalist before. But he is holding his ground. He's not attacking yet, but he's getting ready for what he fears and believes firmly will be a civil war down the road.
We're talking with John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker magazine, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get callers on the line. Chuck is with us. Chuck calling from San Francisco.
Thanks very much. Just an aside, did the bombing have a major effect on the ancient irrigation systems they have there, and did that have any role? But my main question has to do, well, it's more of a comment, and it is that if we destroy their means of subsistence, the opium farmers, without having some sort of substitute crop plan ready to go or in place, it seems like we're very seriously imperiling our potential to succeed in the larger project of bringing development to Afghanistan. And it just seems to me, I heard recently the guy in charge of the military eradication program say that he wasn't really in a position to comment about the success of the crop substitution program, which suggests to me that it's extremely, it has not really progressed very far, even though that this problem has been around for a long time. And that seems rather emblematic of the utterly inadequate development, political, economic dimension to our effort in Afghanistan and also in Iraq. Mm. But mostly, what's the state of the crop substitution program, and doesn't the lack of one imperil our whole project there?
Well, there's a lot to respond to, probably more than we have time for. But, you know, back to the irrigation. I mean, there's artisanal irrigation in Uruzgan, as there is in other parts of Afghanistan. It was degraded
water
in
from
the 30
wells.
Years of civil war. There is very little going on in the way of reconstruction. That's right, water from wells and irrigation ditches. Where there is water, the local farmers do pretty well in creating a little fertile patchwork of fields, whether it's opium or mulberry trees or almond trees or wheat. But, you know, essentially, the entire country's infrastructure has been degraded. So what there was of an infrastructure beginning in the 1970s, which was pretty minimal. As for crop substitution, there's very little going on. It's very hard to do any reconstruction, as we've already seen from Iraq, in a place where, in a situation where the insurgent force effectively controls the countryside. In Uruzgan, for instance, you have about three U.S. Special Forces fire bases, very small. They're essentially a clandestine force. We don't know what they do, but they engage the insurgents here and there. But the security of the province is formally in the hands of the Dutch in this case, in the way that the U.S. has brought in NATO to help it in Afghanistan. Various provinces are apportioned to different member states. Now, the Dutch both disagree with the American style of opium eradication and also counterinsurgency. They hold that it's necessary to reconstruct and employ people first, which, of course, all sounds very good as long as you do it. The fact of the matter is they have been pinned down to their base, whether because of the hostility or for their own political reasons. It's a hot potato at home in the Netherlands. The problem we have is that you have a province that is effectively controlled by the Taliban, a governor who rarely actually comes to Oruzgan, spends most of his time in Kabul, doesn't control much more than his palace, and then outside the provincial capital, a large stockade where there are 2,000 troops who sometimes go on armed patrol outside of it, but effectively can do very little in the way of reconstruction because they have their own force protection issues, which, you know, writ large is some of the problem that's facing the coalition and NATO in Afghanistan itself, much as it put paid to those reconstruction efforts which were initiated in Iraq back in 2003.
Chuck, I'm afraid we're up against it, but thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Very quickly, a lot of people suggest, wouldn't it be cheaper just to buy up all the crop and not put so many soldiers at risk?
There's a lot of debate on this issue, and I've wondered that myself. They lost me in the argument, but effectively pointed out that the amount you would have to spend would only serve as an additional incentive to the to the traffickers. It wouldn't undo the criminal networks at this point. The sad fact of the matter is that in 2001, 2, and 3, the U.S., which was still concerned with Al Qaeda and sorting out the security problem in Afghanistan, looked the other way and did very little about eradication. And now that the opium crop has skyrocketed again.
It's out of control.
It's out of control.
John Lee Anderson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
His story, The Taliban's Opium War, appears in the July 9th and 16th double issue of The New Yorker. This is NPR News.